Hey there, opera fans. I'm Eric Teague. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm primarily a costume designer. You may have seen some of my work in different houses around the U.S., but, fun fact, I'm also a trans man. Ever wondered how alternative identities thrive in the opera world? As someone who makes art for his living, I wanted to explore that question the best way I knew how, by talking to some folks. On this show, I'll speak with other artists who exist under the rainbow umbrella, and talk about life, work, and what makes us shine the brightest. So now I'm wearing a new hat, as your host for Come As You Are, the podcast that goes beyond the curtain with our industry's amazing artists from the LGBTQ+ community and our allies. Think of this as a virtual coffee hour with some fascinating people whose work you've heard or seen in your favorite shows. Whether singers, directors, technicians, or designers, the thing that we share in common is that we all defy the gender expectations often associated with our industry. So grab yourself a cup and join us for a good story. Today on the program, we have a truly special treat. This composer is an internationally known artist with a varied body of work, including the operas As One and Some Light Emerges, orchestral pieces, string quartets, chamber music, and solo piano. She has held positions at New York City's the 92nd Street Y Town Hall and is the artistic director of Symphony Space. She is also the artistic director and co-founder of Musicians Accord, a new music collective in residency at the City College of New York. Our first composer featured here at Come As You Are, please welcome Laura Kaminsky to the show. Thanks for joining us today, Laura.
I'm so glad to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
You're more than welcome. Happy to have you anytime. First up, here at Come As You Are, we like to introduce our identities or orientations up top. For example, I'm your friendly neighborhood trans man with he, him pronouns. How about you?
I am a gay woman, and I never really think about my pronouns too much, but I guess they're she and her.
Awesome. Sounds good. Would you mind telling us a little bit about where and how you grew up?
Sure. I grew up and still live in New York City. I'm a first generation American. My mom is from London and grew up in the Blitz in a bomb shelter, pretty much. And my dad grew up as a poor kid in the Bronx. And they met on, she was just telling this story yesterday, actually, to a friend who was visiting from Lebanon, who wanted to know about my parents' romance and how I ended up in the world. They met on a beach in the south of France when my mother admired my dad's bikini.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, but I grew up in New York City on the Upper West Side of Manhattan near the Museum of Natural History, went to public schools throughout my life as a kid, including the Fiorello H. LaGuardia High School of Music and Art and the Performing Arts, which some people may know from the movie Fame. And I then went off to college in Ohio to Oberlin, where I was not a music major. And then I've sort of traveled and lived around the world. I came back to New York and had some of those jobs that you mentioned. And then I lived in West Africa for over a year in Ghana, where I was kind of hanging out, writing music, studying drumming, and playing in an Afro-pop crossover band. Came back to the States. Then I went and lived in Eastern Europe for a while, based in Poland, running an international music academy, and then came back and lived in Seattle, where I worked at Cornish College of the Arts, which its claim to fame is it was on that stage that John Cage prepared his very first piano, and he and Merce Cunningham met and fell in love. Wow. And it's the same stage where I met my wife, Rebecca, who is a beautiful painter and landscape designer. And we met and fell in love. And then we came back to New York and have been here for about 17 years. So that's my biography in a nutshell.
That's a multi-generational romance story right there.
You got to live for romance because the world's a damn hard place, right?
Oh, that's very true. That's very true. But I can only imagine that your suitcase was literally on fire moving from all those different places.
Pretty battered.
As all the best things are. You never want a knight in shining armor. You want the one that's got some He's got some carbon on him, you know.
You got it.
Totally. So when did you begin your relationship with music? Was it just like breathing for you? Was that the earliest language you understood? Or did becoming a composer happen a little bit more gradually?
So I kind of grew up, as I said, public school education, after school art class, chorus in school as an assigned class. We used to always joke that our conductor, who was an old lady with flabby arms and always wore sleeveless dresses, that we learned syncopation from watching her arms flip on the offbeats. Right. I actually, when I was really young, I kind of thought I was going to be a visual artist. My mom was a artist and a fashion designer, and the visual world was much more present in my childhood. It was sort of like, if we weren't visiting my grandparents on the weekend, we were in a museum. But I was always wanting to make music. And I remember at age 5, I had a play date with a friend from kindergarten and went to her living room for the first time, saw a grand piano. And I was like, oh my God. And I had no, you know, it's like the first time seeing a big instrument like that. And her mom said, you can touch it. And so I started to make, you know, that tinkling away, and was like, this is amazing. And it just kind of intrigued me. So I guess about 5 years later, I was always making up tunes in my head. And I was, my poor sisters, I used to say, okay, Saturday afternoon, we're going to make a show and perform with your mom and dad tonight. And we staged scenes from Sound of Music and Fiddler on the Roof and Cabaret, and, you know, and we memorized them. But then I started making up tunes, and I had to memorize everything because I didn't play instruments or read music. So I asked for piano lessons and started to learn a little bit. But I never really liked practicing that much. It was much more fun to improvise and make things up. And then it got to the point where I couldn't remember everything that I was making up that I liked. So I started teaching myself how to write stuff down. But I never really thought, I mean, I'm not a good performer. I'm too nervous and kind of too lazy to practice in the way that one must. But I never got tired of making music up. So I ended up as a 13-year-old kid in New York, or 12-year-old, you can audition to go to these specialized public high schools. And I thought I was going to put together a portfolio and go to music and art as an art student if they accepted me. And at the very last minute, I had just finished writing up my first piano piece and my first clarinet piece, because I was playing clarinet in my sixth grade band class badly, but nonetheless. And I thought, you know what, this is more fun and I don't know as much. I want to learn this. So I auditioned badly, playing, you know, probably some easy Bach or Mozart piece, and then two pieces of my own, and they accepted me. So I was a music student for high school, and we had all of the regular academic curriculum plus, I think, 3 or 4 classes a day in addition of music every day. So I played in band and I played in the orchestra. I was never very good, but I tried. We had chamber music, but I was always writing music. And because there were so many great musicians, I would write for my friends and we used to play. And so I just kind of did it, but I didn't know that a girl could be a composer. I didn't know that they existed, girl composers. And I wasn't particularly encouraged. So I didn't go to school. I didn't go to college for music. I was a psychology major.
That's incredible. And I think, honestly, that informs the work in so many different ways from the heart, in addition to the ways from the brain and in practice and learning all of the things that, of course, one needs to know as a well-rounded musician, but that heart stuff you can't teach.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you just said resonates so deeply for me, because, you know, I'm not trained in that traditional, you know, 15 years or more that one thinks you need to be. I did end up doing a 2-year master's program in composition, but having done that, I had not had music theory since I was like in 10th grade at music and art. Like I have all these gaps. And so my challenge is always, what am I trying to say and how can I do it honestly? And then groping around in the dark to try to figure out how to write it down in a way that makes sense, that can be then taken. You know, music is a notated language, but it's, you know, it's a roadmap. And so the thing that I always think about is, what are you trying to say and what's the most honest way to say it? And how do you make a narrative that doesn't have words? I'm not talking about opera, but mm-hmm. you know, for most of my career, I didn't set words. I wrote instrumental music. How do you take your listener on a journey that has meaning, even though it's abstract? I mean, you can give a title to a piece, or you can call sections of a piece with subtitles that guide a listener's experience, but the language is abstract. So what is that core truth? And what is that narrative, that through line narrative that has heart and mind, that makes people get captivated and pulled into this world, that you, this sonic landscape that you've created? And I think about it as a sonic landscape. So setting words is kind of daunting because it's specific. They have meaning and you have to be really clear and you have to set them in a way that people can understand them. Or if you don't want them to be understood and you set them so they're not understood, it's because you intended that, not because people think you don't know how to set the word. You know, so
absolutely.
It's a different set of challenges.
Absolutely. It's a delicate balance of a bunch of different things in the air. And
yeah.
plucking them out and putting them in the right puzzle order is, I mean, that's the essence of the art.
Yeah.
So yeah. How do you choose what to write about? Like, do you find that subjects present themselves to you, or are you always on the hunt for some experience that needs to be explored?
I mean, yes. The answer is yes. I would say that a fair amount of the, and again, I didn't start writing opera until I wrote As One. And I was already, you know, a grown up by then, old. And I'd written a lot of instrumental music, mostly chamber music. And the pieces that I wrote could just be abstract sonic landscapes that I put those instruments together over this many minutes with this kind of rhythm and harmony and melody. And that could be the end of it. But more often than not, my way into writing was my way of expressing the way I felt about something in the world, issues that I was addressing. And some were kind of vague and some were very, very specific and concrete. So, I mean, one example that I like to talk about was when I fell in love with my wife, Rebecca, we had been friends for a fairly long time. And it was like, but something was shifting. And it was like, well, wait, when do you know that you started to love somebody as opposed to just like them? Like, what is that moment? Like, what's that transition? And I thought about, well, when does blue become indigo? Or when does blue become teal or turquoise? Like, when is it green and when is it blue and when is it purple? Like, do we all see that or feel that at the same place? So I had a commission to write a chamber music piece, and I'm very much involved with the environment, and you know, mm-hmm. I hike a lot, and I had a garden, but now I work for Rebecca part-time. She has a landscape design business. So
cool.
But this was before she had that business. But nature always provides great metaphors for everything because it's the essence of everything. So I was thinking about the fact that I knew the way I was feeling was different. And I kept coming back to this image of, well, when is blue no longer blue? And when is it green? And when is it purple? And what is that all about? So I wrote a piece called The Full Range of Blue. And I used images from nature of different qualities of blue, you know, the starry night, the water running, the granite stone, and the lupins in the top of the Alpine mountain when I was in the Pacific Northwest. And so each movement tried to musically capture the energy of what I was seeing in my head. Now, nobody had to know any of that to hear the piece. They could say, oh, that one had a nice flute tune, or gee, there was interesting rhythm between the clarinet and the cello, and they were, you know, kind of like bumping up against each other. That was cool. Or they could say, well, this is really boring and turgid. You know, that's fine. That's just responding to the world. But there was this whole backstory, which the listener does or doesn't need to know. I mean, I liked when they knew because they could sort of get a little bit deeper into what I think about and then how I use my thoughts to shape my musical narratives. But the piece had to work even if they didn't know any of that.
Of course.
The ideas generally come to me and I feel a need to make music around an idea. And so with As One, I, first of all, had no thought ever of writing an opera. I hadn't really been paying a huge amount of attention to transgender issues. But my wife and I went to Canada to get married because we couldn't do it in this country. Mm. And we were paying attention as each state was voting, thinking like, what's going to be that moment, that threshold, sure, when it's clear that the Supreme Court's going to take this? And I read an article about an upcoming vote in New Jersey. And I think this was 2007 or eight, maybe. I can't remember exactly. And New Jersey was going to vote. And I said, oh, they're probably going to pass. That would be good. There'll be marriage equality in New Jersey. But the point of this article was they profiled a husband and wife, married couple, committed to each other, raising two kids in the suburbs, and the husband was transitioning. And the point of the article was that if this law did not pass, they would no longer be married, and because they would be a lesbian couple. And I said to Rebecca, wow, this is like an opera. It's like, who are you? And yeah, what are you willing to give up to be fully who you are? And if you become fully who you are, what does that do to your old relationships? Because you're more of yourself, but that's different than the way you were known. But what's core and what changes and what are the challenges? And I just said, this is the stuff of opera. And that's how As One was born.
You're so right. This experience has so much verdant opportunity for storytelling because it's all of that difficult to suss out heart stuff, all of the thoughts of self that are universal, by the way.
That's the point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was obviously, I've got skin in the game. I'm transgender. So I was very interested when I heard that this piece was beginning. And I, of course, I saw different productions here and there and was excited to see the subject matter being addressed just, you know, on the baseline there, but yeah, also to be treated in such a caring way. I was really affected by that.
Thank you. I'm happy to hear that. And yeah, I mean, that was the original intent, was to find the universal humanity of every person's journey to self-actualization. And I was a psychology major in college. And I remember, and I was composing while I was in college. I was at Oberlin. And I actually wanted to write a piece then, and I didn't really know what the text was going to be, but it was based on a book, a famous psychology book called On Becoming a Person.
Hmm.
And I've been asking these questions. Maybe it's because I was gay, and it took a while to acknowledge that, you know, I'm I think a bit older than you, and it wasn't quite so easy. And what was going to be okay and not, and yeah, how do you be fully realized, and what do you lose by doing so? And, you know, I think I've been thinking about those issues for a long time. And so this, I mean, it's so amazing for me and Mark and Kim when we think back to the very beginning. I mean, I had this idea for a year or two before I knew what I was going to do with it. And I owe a lot to my wife, particularly just my joy in getting up in the morning. But she could tell, like, this was really keeping me obsessed. And she was getting me books to read and films to watch. And one night she said, we're going to watch this film. It's called Prodigal Sons. And it was Kim's film. And I said, oh my God, that's the person I need to work with. And I wrote to the film distributor and said, I'd like to talk to Kimberly Reed. I have an idea. And Kim and I met. And it was like she reaffirmed everything that I was thinking, which is I want to tell the story of a trans person's we made a pact that we weren't going to use the word journey, but every now and again it pops up. But a trans person's way to their full realization and ability to be who they were, and that it had to be universal, mm-hmm. and that we were not making a political piece.
Right.
Right. And that's why I think it has resonated, because what Kim said, I got it. I got what you want. And we spent a long time talking about it, and we started designing it, and we already knew it was going to be two singers. Basically, it's a monodrama. This is a person having a dialogue with themselves, and one is the male aspect and one is the female, but it's one person. And people have often said if they didn't know what the storyline was and they just saw some of the duet moments, they would have assumed they were lovers. And in a way, that's the point.
Yeah.
It's about learning to love yourself.
Yes.
And the whole spectrum of who you are. And so Kim and I had all of that kind of worked through, and we actually were designing visual concepts, because we're both, she's a filmmaker, I'm very visual more than musical, I think. And we knew what we wanted to do, but we didn't have the story. She's a filmmaker and a brilliant writer, but not a librettist. And I'm a composer who didn't really know what to do about word setting. I met Mark, and he joined the team, and that's when everything coalesced. And because he understood all of the same issues that we were trying to achieve. And so after a lot of storytelling, Kim, it's not her biography, and she'll probably talk more about this when she speaks with you guys.
Sure.
This is not her biography, but it's about moments in her life, some of which are facts that happened to her, but that resonated as truths for Mark and me too. Like, oh, well, you had that. Well, gee, I know what that feels, you know? And it was like, we were really searching for these core human truths, which is why I think people love Hannah at the end. I mean, she's kind of, you know, a messed up, self-deprecating, slightly self-absorbed, you know, she's kind of doofy, very sensitive, a little slow on the uptake sometimes. I mean, she's like a real person. She's not, you know, she's not an archetype. She's not a stereotype. She's like a real person. People fall in love with her. And I think that's why the piece has resonated for so long.
She is an eminently lovable character.
Yeah, and she's just...
You go through this deeply human journey with her, and you experience her humor, you experience her joy, her elation, but you also experience her fear, her paranoia, her lost relationships, which resonated hard with me for sure. But I know that resonates hard with anybody under the LGBTQ+ umbrella, because part of being your authentic self and coming out in so many ways and transitioning in so many ways is not everyone is going to go on that path with you or support your path. So that moment in the show really, really resonated. And there are tough moments to deal with. Like, you know, there's a near assault in the show. Like, it's a very near miss, but that spike of fear is something that so many people have felt.
Yeah.
And it felt so deeply validating to see it on stage, but done again in such a careful and caring way.
That scene was one that we talked about a lot in the creation of the piece. Because, I mean, and Kim was never assaulted herself, but we all believed that it was critical to address the fact that there's huge amounts of violence against trans people, mm-hmm. particularly trans women of color.
Yes.
But that this is, and that this is global. It's in every community, in every culture, with every religion, with every kind of governmental regime, because it's fear-based.
Yes.
It's about fear of otherness and difference. And so figuring out how to do that scene, we didn't want Hannah to be battered and in a hospital.
Yes.
We needed this not to be a tragic piece, but we needed to have gravity.
Yes.
And gravitas. So it was a near miss for her, but it was the moment that sparked her to see herself in the bigger world and to understand contextually this bigger world that she's not alone and she can be who she is, but there are people who can't. And she has to kind of embrace the whole of it mm-hmm. and seek to live her truth. And it's very powerful because what happens is as Hannah after the female voice, the higher voice, is attacked, she goes home and opens up her laptop and starts researching and says, oh my God, this is happening everywhere. I'm not alone. Wow. And in the background, the male voice is reciting actual names of people all over the globe. I mean, this was one of the most horrific parts of this. Mark and Kim got me the list and said, pick and choose, you know, and I was like, oh my God, these are real people.
Yeah.
This is a real person who was run over repeatedly by a car and had their genitals stuffed in their mouth. And they were somebody's child or lover or, you know, best athlete in kindergarten or made the prettiest flower pictures. I mean, these are people all over the world. And it was so hard to write it. And I actually had to rewrite it because it was too intense. And originally all of those names were also sung. So there was a duet and it was so incredibly intense that we did it as a quiet recitation that sort of murmurs until it becomes full voice when they finally sing together, almost like a prayer.
Yeah, that's exactly how I interpreted it, because it feels like the appropriate reverence being paid to these victims of horrible violence who yeah. in all likelihood were just living their lives.
I'm sure.
And I love that y'all encourage different productions to bring in names of people who are part of the community.
Yeah.
And so we are following suit in our Atlanta production as well.
Violence and destruction of innocent life is generally, I think, coming out of fear, this fear-based hatred. And I think that that's true with victims, you know, trans victims of abuse.
And the whole point of us having this conversation and all of the other conversations that I've had with my colleagues on this podcast is about, in some tiny little way, chipping away at somebody's fear. My hope is that someone who's listening to this podcast is going to say, hey, these are just normal people. These are normal artists doing extraordinary things. And maybe their life experience is unnecessarily hard in some ways. And maybe I can do something to fix that or help it at least. That's my hope, my dearest hope. And being able to work on pieces like this, it's extremely powerful. Because representation does matter, as we well know. Because if I had seen somebody doing a piece like this in my young life, things would not have been so bleak.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, we make art because we're trying to communicate. Yeah. And as I said, this was not conceived as a political piece. It was conceived as a human piece. But it's the individual humanity that you go from that to the bigger picture, and that's when change can happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So to bring back a little bit to the joy.
Yes, I was thinking we went down a pretty dark hole, but it's necessary.
I'm so sorry. I'm a goth kid. Sometimes it gets dark. But I'd love to talk for a moment about what makes this particular production at the Atlanta Opera different from previous versions. We're so thankful to have your gracious blessing for our production, and it breaks the mold just a little bit by casting Lucia Lucas in the role of Hannah before and Blythe Gassert in the role of Hannah after, but really it's more like Hannah through. So
yes.
Hannah is present at all times in different aspects of herself. So our version is a little bit like Hannah is going through her attic of memories and reliving some moments in her past that were probably a little bit awkward, maybe a little bit hard to deal with at the time, and she put them away to deal with later. So now right. She's going through things and releasing the memories that don't serve her well anymore. So before and after turn more into present and idealized version, the version of herself that she always wanted to be and always had in her mind.
I think what's so beautiful about that, and there have been, you know, this is the 51st production. And so there have been a lot of different thoughtful, sensitive minds coming to this piece and twisting it and turning it in different ways. And there have been some productions that sort of were along these lines where there's, you know, all of who you are is also all of who you were, and it's one. Yeah. And what do you hold and what do you let go of in order to be fully blossoming? So I think that's what this production is trying to achieve. And I love that. I'm just going to say, this whole notion of Hannah before and Hannah after was sort of a last minute, like we didn't know. We did not have a name for our character. We just knew that this was a dialogue with self, and there was going to be a baritone voice and a mezzo voice. And it was not, it was also, that was because I was writing for two specific singers who I trusted and loved and wanted to do a project with them. And it was like, would you do this monodrama where you're sort of sharing a character? And they said, that sounds cool. I mean, that's how this all started. And we were sitting in workshop rehearsal in Utah, and we knew that we needed to provide a description for the first press release, and we didn't have a name for our character yet. And, you know, we had long conversations. Should this be a gender neutral name? Should there be a before name and an after, you know, a dead name and a taken on name? How do we think about this? I mean, we had not grappled with it. And I think Mark said, we should just have one name because we have to clarify that this is one person. So it could have been a gender-free name. And it was funny because our two cast members, who happen to be a cisgender married couple, both have gender-neutral names. It's Sasha Cook and Kelly Markroff. And both Sasha and Kelly could be male or female.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, we were sort of always calling it Sasha, it, her.
Sure.
But we didn't have a name. And Mark just looked up at Kim and me and said, I think we should call her Hannah. And it's like, well, why? He said, it's a beautiful name. And he said, and it's good to sing, but we actually never sing the name in the piece.
That's right.
I said, actually, what's fantastic is that it's a palindrome. It reads the same way forwards and backwards. I said, but let's look up the root meaning of the name. What's its etymology? And it means coming from grace. And I was like, this is perfect. And then Mark, in his astuteness, having written more libretti than anyone alive on the planet, said, you know, we can't just call this person Hannah because they won't know who's singing what. So we could do Hannah 1 and Hannah 2, but that seems kind of weird. And I think Kim may have come up with Hannah before and Hannah after. And what we realize now, all these years later, is that that causes some bit of problematic because Hannah before never goes away and Hannah after was always there. It's Hannah always, always.
Correct.
So, you know, we kind of created a radical thing by having our person have one name, and then by differentiating it, it challenged some people. But I think people understand the good intention from the beginning in all of this. Yeah. I mean, when we premiered the piece in 2008 at BAM, the expression, the word cisgender had just come. Nobody knew what it meant. We had to give that definition on a panel discussion because nobody had heard it in the audience. Look how far we've come in 8 years. I mean, as horrible as the backlashes continue to be, we are making progress. And as much as we have to fight all these reactionary laws that keep trying to be put in place, and there will be setbacks, we are making progress. And every setback is a gut punch on so many issues right now, not just trans issues, but women's right to choose how to take care of their bodies,
yes,
LGBT marriages. I think all of this stuff is being challenged out of fear, as usual. And some things will lose in the short term, and we will agonize over those losses, and we'll pick ourselves up and keep going forward. But society moves forward slowly. And so it's all good in the end. It's, you know, it's a slow slog. We humans are not very smart. But we keep trying. Good wins out. Bad wins in the short term, good wins in the long term.
Well, I couldn't have wrapped it up better myself. I mean, that, let's leave it on that moment of hope, because we need it.
Yeah.
We absolutely need it. Well, if you would like, dear audience members, to see Laura's work live here in Atlanta, tickets are now on sale for As One. So please go to atlantaopera.com and grab your tickets today. As I said, there are only two performances, so please don't wait. Additionally, you can listen to Laura's work online and purchase her albums on all major platforms. And if you would like to see some of my work as well, you can certainly come see the show. Or you can check out my site, ericteaguedesign.com, and Opergeist on Etsy and Instagram. A huge thanks goes out to the team at the Atlanta Opera for making this podcast possible. And if you've enjoyed our show today, please don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And like and subscribe everywhere else fine podcasts are downloaded. And as always, y'all means all. So come as you are, and your spotlight is waiting. Bye, y'all.